And he felt as a murderer must feel when he beholds the body he has robbed of life. That body, robbed by him of life, was their love, the first stage of their love. There was something awful and revolting in the memory of what had been bought at this fearful price of shame. Shame at her spiritual nakedness crushed her and infected him. But in spite of all the murderer's horror before the body of his victim, he must hack it to pieces, hide the body, must use what the murderer had gained by his murder. And as the murderer, with fury, and as it were with passion, falls on the body and drags it and hacks at it, so he covered her face and shoulders with kisses. She held his hand and did not stir. Yes, and these kisses, that is what has brought on this shame. Yes, and this one hand, which will always be mine, the hand of my accomplice. She lifted up that hand and kissed it. He sank on his knees and tried to see her face, but she hid it and said nothing. At last, as though making an effort over herself, she got up and pushed him away. Her face was still as beautiful, but it was only the more pitiful for that. "All is over," she said. "I have nothing but you. Remember that. I can never forget what is my whole life for one instant of this happiness." "Happiness," she said with horror and loathing, and her horror unconsciously infected him. "For God's sake, not a word more." She rose quickly and moved away from him. "Not a word more," she repeated, and with a look of chill despair, incomprehensible to him, she parted from him. She felt that at that moment she could not put into words the sense of shame, of rapture, and of horror at this stepping into a new life, and she did not want to speak of it, to vulgarize this feeling in inappropriate words. But later, too, and the next day and the day after, she still found no words in which she could express the complexity of those feelings. Indeed, she could not even find thoughts in which she could clearly think out all that was in her soul. She said to herself, "No, just now I can't think of it. Later on, when I am calmer." But this calm for thoughts never came. Every time the thought rose out of what she had done and what would happen to her and what she ought to do, a horror came over her, and she drove those thoughts away. "Later, later," she said, "when I am calmer." But in her dreams, when she had no control over her thoughts, her position presented itself to her in all its hideous nakedness. One dream haunted her almost every night. She dreamed that both were husbands at once, that both were lavishing caresses on her. Alexei Alexandrovich was weeping, kissing her hands, and saying, "How happy we are now." And Alexei Vronsky was there, too, and he, too, was her husband. And she was marveling that it had once seemed impossible to her, was explaining to them, laughing, that this was ever so much simpler, and that now both of them were happy and contented. But this dream weighed on her like a nightmare, and she would awake from it in terror. Chapter 12. In the early days after his return from Moscow, whenever Levin shuddered and grew red, remembering the disgrace of his rejection, he would say to himself, "This was just how I used to shudder and blush, thinking everything utterly lost, when I was flunked in physics and did not get promoted. And this is also how I thought myself utterly ruined after I had mismanaged that affair of my sister's with which I had been entrusted. And yet now that the years have passed, I recall it and wonder that it could distress me so much. It will be the same thing with this trouble as well. Time will go by, and I shall not mind this either." But 3 months had passed, and he had not left off minding about it, and it was as painful for him to think of it now as it had been during those first days. He could not be at peace because, after dreaming so long of family life and feeling himself so ripe for it, he was still not married and was farther than ever from marriage. He was painfully conscious himself, as were all about him, that at his years it is not good that man should be alone. He remembered how, before starting from Moscow, he had once said to his cowherd, Nikolai, a simple-hearted peasant to whom he liked to talk, "Well, Nikolai, I mean to get married." And how Nikolai had promptly answered, as of a matter on which there could be no possible doubt. And high time, too, Konstantin Dmitrich. But marriage had now become farther off than ever. The place was taken, and whenever he tried to imagine any of the girls he knew in that place, he felt that it was utterly impossible. Moreover, the recollection of the rejection and the part he had played in the affair tortured him with shame. However often he told himself that he was in no wise to blame in it, that recollection, like other similarly humiliating recollections, made him wince and blush. There had been in his past, as in every man's actions, recognized by him as bad, for which his conscience ought to have tormented him. But the recollection of these evil actions was far from causing him as much suffering as these trivial but humiliating recollections. These wounds never healed, and with these recollections he now ranged his rejection in the sorry plight in which he must have appeared to others that evening. Yet time and labor were doing their work. Bitter recollections were more and more being covered up by the incidents, inconspicuous ones but important, of his country life. Every week he thought less often of Kitty. He was impatiently looking forward to the news that she was married, or just going to be married, hoping that such news would, like having a tooth out, completely cure him. Meanwhile, spring came on, beautiful and kindly, without the delays and treacheries incident to spring, one of those rare springs in which plants, beasts, and man rejoice alike. This lovely spring roused Levin still more and strengthened him in his resolution of renouncing all his past and building up his lonely life firmly and independently. Though many of the plans with which he had returned to the country had not been carried out, his most important resolution, that of purity of life, had nevertheless been kept by him. He was free from that shame which had usually harassed him after a fall, and he could look everyone straight in the face. In February, he had received a letter from Maria Nikolaevna telling him that his brother Nikolai's health was getting worse, but that he would not take advice, and in consequence of this letter, Levin went to Moscow to his brother's and succeeded in persuading him to see a doctor and to go to a watering place abroad. He succeeded so well in persuading his brother and in lending him money for the journey without irritating him that he was satisfied with himself on that score. In addition to his farming, which called for special attention in spring, in addition to reading, Levin had begun that winter a work on agriculture, the plan of which turned on taking into account the character of the laborer on the land as one of the unalterable data of the question, like the climate and the soil, and consequently deducing all the principles of scientific culture, not simply from the data of soil and climate, but from the data of soil, climate, and a certain unalterable character of the laborer. Thus, in spite of his solitude, or in consequence of his solitude, life was exceedingly full, save that, on rare occasions, he suffered from an unsatisfied desire to communicate his stray ideas to someone besides Agatha Mikhailovna. With her, indeed, he not infrequently fell into discussions upon physics, the theory of agriculture, and especially philosophy. Philosophy was Agatha Mikhailovna's favorite subject. Spring was slow in unfolding. For the last few weeks of Lent it had been steadily fine and frosty weather. In the daytime there was a thaw in the sun, but at night there were as many as 7 degrees of frost. The snow was so packed and frozen that loads could be carried along anywhere, regardless of roads. Easter came in snow. Then all of a sudden, on Easter Monday, a warm wind sprang up. Storm clouds swooped down, and for 3 days and 3 nights, the warm, tempestuous rain fell in torrents. On Thursday, the wind dropped, and the thick gray fog brooded over the land, as though screening the mysteries of the transformations that were being wrought in nature. Behind the fog, there was the flowing of water, the cracking and floating of ice, the swift rush of turbid, foaming torrents, and on the following Monday, in the evening, the fog parted, the storm clouds split up into little curling crests of cloud, the sky cleared, and the real spring had come. In the morning, the sun arose brilliant and quickly wore away the thin layer of ice that covered the water, and all the warm air was quivering with the steam that rose up from the quickened earth. The old grass looked greener, and the young grass thrust up its tiny blades. The buds of the golden rose and of the currant and the sticky birch buds were swollen with sap, and an exploring bee was humming about the golden blossoms that studded the willow. Larks trilled unseen above the velvety green fields and ice-covered stubble land. Peewits wailed over the lowlands and marshes, flooded by the pools. Cranes and wild geese flew high across the sky, uttering their spring calls. The cattle, bald in patches where the new hair had not grown yet, lowed in the pastures. Bow-legged lambs frisked round their bleating dams, who were shedding their fleece. Nimble-footed children ran along the drying paths, covered with the prints of bare feet. There was a merry chatter of peasant women over their linen at the pond, and the ring of axes in the yard where the peasants were repairing plows and harrows. The real spring had come. Chapter 13. Levin put on his big boots and for the first time a cloth overcoat instead of his fur cloak, and went out to look after his farm. Stepping over streams of water that flashed in the sunshine and dazzled his eyes, and stepping one minute on ice and the next into sticky mud. Spring is the time of plans and projects, and as he came out into the farmyard, Levin, like a tree in spring that knows not what form will be taken by the young shoots and twigs imprisoned in its swelling buds, hardly knew what undertakings he was going to launch upon now in the farm work that was so dear to him. But he felt that he was full of the most splendid plans and projects. First of all, he went to the cattle. The cows had been let out into their paddock, and their smooth sides were already glossy with their new, sleek spring coats. They basked in the sunshine and lowed to go to the meadow. Levin gazed admiringly at the cows he knew so intimately to the minutest detail of their condition, and gave orders for them to be driven out into the meadow, and the calves to be led into the paddock. The herdsmen ran gaily to get ready for the meadow. The cowherd girls, picking up their petticoats, ran splashing through the mud with bare legs, still white, not yet brown from the sun, waving brushwood in their hands, chasing the calves that frolicked in the mirth of spring. After admiring the increase of that year, which were particularly fine, the early calves were the size of a peasant's cow, and Pava's daughter, at 3 months old, was as big as a yearling. Levin gave orders for a trough to be brought out and hay to be put in the racks. But it appeared that, since the paddock had not been used during the winter, the racks made in the autumn were broken. He sent for the carpenter, who, according to his orders, ought to have been at work at the threshing machine. But it appeared that the carpenter was preparing the harrows, which ought to have been repaired before Lent. This was very annoying to Levin. It was annoying to come upon that everlasting slovenliness in the farm work against which he had been striving with all his might for so many years. The racks, as he ascertained, being not wanted in winter, had been carried to the cart horses' stable, and there broken, as they were of light construction, only meant for foddering calves. Moreover, it was apparent also that the harrows and all the agricultural implements, which he had directed to be looked over and repaired in the winter, for which very purpose he had hired 3 carpenters, had not been put into repair, and the harrows were being repaired when they ought to have been harrowing the field. Levin sent for his bailiff, but immediately went off himself to look for him. The bailiff, beaming all over, like everything that day, in a sheepskin bordered with astrakhan, came out of the barn twisting a bit of straw in his hands. "Why isn't the carpenter at the threshing machine?" "Oh, I meant to tell you yesterday, the harrows want repairing. Here it's time they got to work in the fields." "But what were they doing in the winter then?" "But what did you want the carpenter for?" "Where are the racks for the calves' paddock?" "I ordered them to be got ready." "What would you have with those people?" said the bailiff with a wave of his hand. "It's not those people, but this bailiff," said Levin, getting angry. "Why, what do I keep you for?" he cried. But bethinking himself that this would not help matters, he stopped short in the middle of a sentence and merely sighed. Well, what do you say? Can sewing begin? He asked after a pause. Behind Torquino, tomorrow or next day they might begin. And the clover? I've sent Vasily and Mishka. They're sewing it. Only I don't know if they'll manage to get through. It's so slushy. How many disiatinas? Six. Why not sew all? Cried Levin. That they were only sowing the clover in six desiatinas, not in all 20, was still more annoying to him. Clover, as he knew both from books and from his own experience, never did well except when it was sown as early as possible, almost in the snow. And yet Levin could never get this done. There's no one to send. What would you do with such people? Three haven't turned up. And there's Simeon. Well, you should have taken some men from the chaff cutter. And so I have, as it is. Where are the peasants, then? Five are making compote, which meant compost, and four are shifting the oats for fear of being touched, Konstantin Dmitrich. Levin knew very well that touching meant that his English seed oats were already spoiled. Again, they had not done as he had ordered. Why, but I told you during Lent to put in pipes, he cried. Don't be put out. We shall get it all done in time. Levin made an angry gesture and went into the granary to glance at the oats and then to the stable. The oats were not yet spoiled, but the laborers were carrying the oats in spades when they might simply let them slide down into the lower granary, and arranging for this to be done and taking two laborers from there for sowing clover, Levin got over the vexation his bailiff had caused him. Indeed, it was such a lovely day that one could not be angry. Ignat, he called to the coachman, who with his sleeves tucked up was washing the carriage wheels. Saddle. Which, sir? Well, let it be Kolpik. Yes, sir. While they were saddling his horse, Levin again called the bailiff, who was hanging about in sight to make it up with him, and began talking to him about the spring operations before them and his plans for the farming. The wagons were to begin carting manure earlier so as to get all done before the early mowing, and the plowing of the outlying land was to go on without a break so as to let it lie black, fallow, and furrowed, and the moving to be all done by hired labor, not on half profits. The bailiff listened attentively and obviously made an effort to approve of his employer's projects, but still he had that look Levin knew so well that always irritated him, a look of hopelessness and despondency. That look said, "That's all very well, but as God wills." Nothing mortified Levin so much as that tone, but it was the tone common to all the bailiffs he had ever had. They had all taken that attitude to his plans, and so now he was not angered by it, but mortified, and felt all the more roused to struggle against this apparently elemental force continually ranged against him, for which he could find no other name than "as God wills." If we can manage it, Konstantin Dmitrich, said the bailiff, why shouldn't you manage it? We positively must have 15 laborers more, and they don't turn up. There were some here today asking 70 rubles for the summer. Levin was silent. Again, he was brought face to face with that opposing force. He knew that however much they tried, they could not hire more than 40, 37, perhaps, or 38 laborers for a reasonable sum. Some 40 had been taken on, and there were no more. But still he could not help struggling against it. Send to Surrey, to Sheferovka, if they don't come. We must look for them. I'll send to be sure, said Vasily Fyodorovich, despondently. But then there are the horses. They're not good for much. We'll get some more. I know, of course, Levin added, laughing. You always want to do with as little and as poor a quality as possible. But this year, I'm not going to let you have things your own way. I'll see to everything myself. Why, I don't think you take much rest as it is. It cheers us up to work under the master's eye. So they're sowing clover behind the Birchdale? I'll go and have a look at them, he said, mounting the little bay cob, Kolpik, who was led up by the coachman. You can't get across the stream, Konstantin Dmitrich, the coachman shouted. All right, I'll go by the forest. And Levin rode through the slush of the farmyard to the gate and out into the open country. his good little horse, after his long inactivity, ambling easily, snorting over the pools, and asking, as it were, for guidance. If Levin had felt happy before in the cattle pens and farmyard, he felt happier yet in the open country, swaying rhythmically with the ambling paces of his good little cob, drinking in the warm yet fresh scent of the snow in the air, as he rode through his forest over the crumbling wasted snow, still left in parts and covered with dissolving tracks. He rejoiced over every tree with the moss reviving on its bark and the buds swelling on its shoots. When he came out of the forest in the immense plain before him, his winter field stretched in an unbroken carpet of green, without one bare place or swamp, only spotted here and there in the hollows with patches of melting snow. He was not put out of temper even by the sight of the peasant's horse and colt trampling down his young grass. He told the peasant he met to drive them out, nor by the sarcastic and stupid reply of the peasant, Ipat, whom he met on the way and asked, "Well, Ipat, shall we soon be sowing?" "We must get the plowing done first, Konstantin Dmitrich," answered Ipat. The farther he rode, the happier he became, and plans for the land rose to his mind, each better than the last. To plant all his fields with hedges along the southern borders, so that the snow should not lie under them, to divide them up into 6 fields of tillage and 3 for pasture and hay, to build a cattle yard at the farther end of the estate, and to dig a pond and to construct movable pens for the cattle as a means of manuring the land. And then 300 desiatinas of wheat, 100 of potatoes, and 150 of clover, and not a desiatina exhausted. Absorbed in such dreams, carefully keeping his horse by the hedges so as not to trample his young winter fields, he rode up to the laborers who had been sent to sow clover. A telega with a seed in it was standing, not at the edge, but in the middle of the tillage, and the winter corn had been torn up by the wheels and trampled by the horse. Both the laborers were sitting in the hedge, probably smoking a pipe, turn and turn about. The earth in the telega with which the seed was mixed was not crushed to powder, but crusted together or adhering in clods. Seeing the master, the laborer, Vasily, went toward the telega, while Mishka set to work sewing. This was not as it should be, but with the laborers, Levin seldom lost his temper. When Vasily came up, Levin told him to lead the horse to the hedge. "Never mind, sir, it'll spring up again," responded Vasily. "Please don't argue," said Levin, "but do as you're told." "Yes, sir," answered Vasily, and he took the horse's head. "What a sewing, Konstantin Dmitrich," he said ingratiatingly. "First rate, only it's a work to get about. A fellow drags 30 pounds of earth at every step." "Why is it that you have earth that's not sifted?" said Levin. "Well, we crumble it up," answered Vasily, taking up some seed and rolling the earth in his palms. Vasily was not to blame for their having fired up his telega with unsifted earth, but still it was annoying. Levin had already more than once tried a way he knew for stifling his anger and turning all that seemed dark right again, and he tried that way now. He watched how Mishka strode along, swinging the huge clods of earth that clung to each foot, and getting off his horse, he took the sieve from Vasily and started sowing himself. "Where did you stop?" Vasily pointed to the mark with his foot, and Levin went forward as best he could, scattering the seed on the land. Walking was as difficult as on a bog, and by the time Levin had ended the row, he was in a great heat, and stopping, gave the sieve over to Vasily. "Well, master, when summer's here, mind you don't scold me for this row," said Vasily. "Eh?" said Levin cheerily, already feeling the effect of his method. "Why, you'll see in the summertime, it'll look different. Look you where I sowed last spring. How I did work at it, I do my best. Konstantin Dmitrich, you see, as I would for my own father. I don't like botch work myself, nor would I let another man do it. What's good for the master is good for us, too. It does one's heart good," said Vasily, pointing, "to look over yonder. It's a lovely spring, Vasily." "Why, it's a spring such as even the old men don't remember the like of. I was up home. My father there has sown wheat, too, 3 osaminas of it. He was saying he couldn't tell it from rye." "Have you been sowing wheat long?" Why, sir, it was taught us the year before last. You gave me two measures. We sold about one shetfer and sold three osmanas. Well, mind you crumble up the clod, said Levin, going toward his horse, and keep an eye on Mishka. And if there's a good crop, you shall have half a ruble for every disyantina. Thank you kindly. We are very well content, sir, with your treatment as it is. Levin got on his horse and rode toward the field where last year's clover was, and the one which was plowed ready for the spring corn. The crop of clover coming up in the stubble was magnificent. It had revived already and stood up vividly green through the broken stalks of last year's wheat. The horse sank in up to the pasterns, and he drew each hoof with a sucking sound out of the half-thawed ground. Over the plow land, the riding was utterly impossible. The horse could only keep a foothold where there was ice, and in the thawing furrows he sank in deep at each step. The plow land was in splendid condition. In a couple of days it would be fit for harrowing and sowing. Everything was capital. Everything was cheering. Levin rode back across the streams, hoping the water would have gone down, and he did, in fact, get across and startled two ducks. There must be woodcock here, too, he thought. And just as he reached the turning homewards, he met the forest keeper, who confirmed his theory about the woodcock. Levin went home in a trot, so as to have time to eat his dinner and get his gun ready for the evening. Chapter 14. As he rode up to the house in the happiest frame of mind, Levin heard the bell ring at the side of the principal entrance of the house. Yes, that's someone from the railway station, he thought. Just in time to be here from the Moscow train. Who could it be? What if it's Brother Nikolai? He did say, I may go to the waters, or I may come down to you. He felt dismayed and vexed for the first minute that his Brother Nikolai's presence should come to his happy mood of spring. But he felt ashamed of the feeling, and at once he opened, as it were, the arms of his soul, and with a softened feeling of joy and expectation, he now hoped with all his heart that it was his brother. He spurred on his horse, and as he rode out from behind the acacias, he saw a hired troika from the railway station and a gentleman in a fur coat. It was not his brother. Oh, if it were only some pleasant person one could talk to a little, he thought. Ah, cried Levin, joyfully flinging up both his hands. Here's a delightful visitor. Ah, how glad I am to see you, he shouted, recognizing Stepan Arkadyevich. I shall find out for certain whether she's married or when she's going to be married, he thought. And on that delicious spring day he felt that the thought of her did not hurt him at all. Didn't expect me, did you, said Stepan Arkadyevich, getting out of the sleigh, splashed with mud on the bridge of his nose, on his cheek, and on his eyebrows, but radiant with health and good spirits. I've come primarily to see you, he said, embracing and kissing him, secondly, to have some stand shooting, and thirdly, to sell the forest at Ergushova. Delightful. What a spring we're having. However did you get along in a sleigh? In a wagon it would have been worse still, Konstantin Dmitrievich answered the driver, who knew him. Well, I'm very, very glad to see you, said Levin with a genuine smile of childlike delight. Levin led his friend to the guest room where Stepan Arkadyevich's things were also carried, a bag, a gun in a case, a satchel for cigars. Leaving him there to wash and change his clothes, Levin went off to the counting house to speak about the plowing and the clover. Agatha Mikhailovna, always very anxious for the credit of the house, met him in the hall with inquiries about dinner. Do just as you like, only let it be as soon as possible, he said, and went to the bailiff. When he came back, Stepan Arkadyevich, washed and combed, came out of his room with a beaming smile, and they went upstairs together. Well, I am glad I managed to get away to you. Now I shall understand what the mysterious business is that you are always absorbed in here. No, really, I envy you. What a house. How splendid it all is. So bright, so cheerful, said Stepan Arkadyevich, forgetting that it was not always spring and fine weather as on this day. And your old nurse is simply charming. A pretty maid in an apron might be even more agreeable, perhaps. But for your severe monastic style, it does very well. Stepan Arkadyevich imparted to him many interesting bits of news. Especially interesting to Levin was the news that his brother, Sergei Ivanovich, was intending to spend the summer with him in the country. Not one word did Stepan Arkadyevich say in reference to Kitty and the Shcherbatskys. He merely gave him greetings from his wife. Levin was grateful to him for his delicacy and rejoiced exceedingly over his guest. As always happened with him during his solitude, a mass of ideas and feelings had been accumulating within him, which he could not communicate to those about him. And now he poured out upon Stepan Arkadyevich his poetic joy over the spring, and his failures and plans for the land, and his thoughts and criticisms on the books he had been reading, and the idea of his own book, the basis of which really was, though he was unaware of it himself, a criticism of all the old books on agriculture. Stepan Arkadyevich, always charming, understanding everything at the slightest reference, was particularly charming on this visit, and Levin noticed in him a special tenderness, as it were, and a new tone of respect that flattered him. The efforts of Agatha Mikhailovna and the cook to have the dinner particularly good only ended in the two famished friends attacking the preliminary course, eating a great deal of bread and butter, salt goose, and salted mushrooms, and in Levin's finally ordering the soup to be served without the accompaniment of little patties, with which the cook had particularly meant to impress their visitor. But though Stepan Arkadyevich was accustomed to very different dinners, he thought everything excellent, the herb brandy and the bread and the butter, and above all the salt goose and mushrooms, and the nettle soup, and the chicken and white sauce, and the white Crimean wine. Everything was excellent and marvelous. "Splendid, splendid," he said, lighting a fat cigar after the roast. "I feel as if, coming to you, I had landed on a peaceful shore after the noise and jolting of a steamer." "And so you maintain that the laborer himself is an element to be studied, and to regulate the choice of methods in agriculture. Of course, I'm an ignorant outsider, but I should fancy theory and its application will have its influence on the laborer, too." "Yes, but wait a bit. I'm not talking of political economy. I'm talking of the science of agriculture. It ought to be like the natural sciences, and to observe given phenomena, and the laborer in his economic, ethnographical..." At that instant, Agatha Mikhailovna came in with jam. "Oh, Agatha Fyodorovna," said Stepan Arkadyevich, kissing the tips of his plump fingers, "what salt goose, what herb brandy. What do you think? Isn't it time to start, Kostya?" he added. Levin looked out of the window at the sun sinking behind the bare treetops of the forest. "Yes, it's time," he said. "Kuzma, get ready the wine, droshky," and he ran downstairs. Stepan Arkadyevich, going down, carefully took the canvas cover off his varnished gun case with his own hands and, opening it, began to get ready his expensive, new-fashioned gun. Kuzma, who already scented a big tip, never left Stepan Arkadyevich's side and put on him both his stockings and boots, a task which Stepan Arkadyevich readily left to him. "Kostya, give orders that if the merchant Rabinin comes, I told him to come today. He's to be shown in and asked to wait for me." "Why, do you mean to say you're selling the forest to Rabinin?" "Yes, do you know him?" "To be sure I do. I have had to do business with him, positively and definitively." Stepan Arkadyevich laughed. "Positively and definitively" were the merchant's favorite words. "Yes, it's wonderfully funny the way he talks. She knows where her master's going," he added, patting Laska, who hung about Levin, whining and licking his hands, his boots, and his gun. The droshky was already at the steps when they went out. "I told them to bring the droshky round, though it's not far to go, or would you rather walk?" "No, we'd better drive," said Stepan Arkadyevich, getting into the droshky. He sat down, tucked the tiger-striped rug around him, and lighted a cigar. "How is it you don't smoke?" "A cigar is a sort of thing, not exactly a pleasure, but the crown and outward sign of pleasure. Come, this is life, how splendid it is. This is how I should like to live." "Why, who prevents you?" said Levin, smiling. "No, you're a lucky man. You've got everything you like. You like horses, and you have them. Dogs, you have them. Shooting, you have it. Farming, you have it. Perhaps because I rejoice in what I have, and don't fret for what I haven't," said Levin, thinking of Kitty. Stepan Arkadyevich comprehended, looked at him, but said nothing. Levin was grateful to Oblonsky for noticing, with his never-failing tact, that he dreaded conversation about the Shcherbatskys, and so saying nothing about them. But now Levin was longing to find out about that which was tormenting himself, yet had not the courage to begin. "Come, tell me how things are going with you," said Levin, bethinking himself that it was not good of him to think only of himself. Stepan Arkadyevich's eyes sparkled merrily. "You don't admit, I know, that one can be fond of new roles when one has had one's ration of bread. To your mind, it's a crime, but I don't count life as life without love," he said, taking Levin's question in his own way. "What am I to do? I'm made that way. And really, one does so little harm to anyone and gives oneself so much pleasure." "What, is there something new then?" queried Levin. "Yes, my boy, there is. There, do you see, you know the type of Ossian's women, women such as one sees in dreams. Well, these women are sometimes to be met with in reality, and these women are terrible. Women, don't you know, is such a subject that no matter how much you study it, it's always perfectly new." "Well, then, it would be better not to study it." "No, some mathematician has said that enjoyment lies in the search for truth, not in the finding of it." Levin listened in silence, and in spite of all the efforts he made, he could not in the least enter into the feeling of his friend and understand his sentiments and the charm of studying such women. Chapter 15. The place fixed on for the stand shooting was not far above a stream in a little aspen copse. On reaching the copse, Levin got out of the droshky and led Oblonsky to a corner of a mossy, swampy glade already quite free from snow. He went back himself to a double birch tree on the other side, and leaning his gun on the fork of a dead lower branch, he took off his full overcoat, fastened his belt again, and worked his arms to see if they were free. Gray old Laska, who had followed them, sat down wearily opposite him and pricked up her ears. The sun was setting behind a thick forest, and in the glow of sunset, the birch trees, dotted about in the aspen copse, stood out clearly with their hanging twigs and their buds swollen almost to bursting. From the thickest parts of the copse, where the snow still remained, came the faint sound of narrow, winding streamlets of water running away. Tiny birds twittered and now and then fluttered from tree to tree. In the pauses of complete stillness, there came the rustle of last year's leaves, stirred by the thawing of the earth and the growth of grasses. "Imagine, one can hear and see the grass growing," Levin said to himself, noticing a wet, slate-colored aspen leaf moving beside a blade of young grass. He stood, listened, and gazed sometimes down at the wet, mossy ground, sometimes at Laska listening all alert, sometimes at the sea of bare treetops that stretched on the slope below him, sometimes at the darkening sky covered with white streaks of cloud. A hawk flew high over a forest far away, with a slow sweep of its wings. Another flew with exactly the same motion in the same direction and vanished. The birds twittered more and more loudly and busily in the thicket. An owl hooted not far off, and Laska, starting, stepped cautiously a few steps forward, and putting her head on one side, began to listen intently. Beyond the stream was heard the cuckoo. Twice she uttered her usual call and then became hoarse, hurried, and broke down, said Stepan Arkadyevich, coming out from behind a bush. "Yes, I hear it," answered Levin, reluctantly breaking the stillness with his voice, which sounded disagreeable to himself. "Now it's coming." Stepan Arkadyevich's figure again went behind the bush, and Levin saw nothing but the bright flash of a match, followed by the red glow and blue smoke of a cigarette. "Tick, tick," came the snapping sound of Stepan Arkadyevich's cocking his gun. "What's that cry?" asked Oblonsky, drawing Levin's attention to a prolonged cry, as though a colt were whinnying in a high voice in play. "Oh, don't you know it? That's a buck hare, but enough talking. Listen, here it comes," almost shrieked Levin, cocking his gun. They heard a shrill whistle in the distance, and in the exact time, so well known to the sportsman. 2 seconds later, another, a third, and after the third whistle, the hoarse, guttural cry could be heard. Levin looked about him to right and left, and there just facing him against the dusky blue sky, above the confused mass of tender shoots of the aspens, he saw the flying bird. It was flying straight toward him, the guttural cry, like the even tearing of some strong stuff, sounded close to his ear. The long beak and neck of the bird could be seen, and at the very instant when Levin was taking aim, behind the bush where Oblonsky stood, there was a flash of red lightning. The bird dropped like an arrow and darted upward again. Again came the red flash and the sound of a blow and fluttering its wings as though trying to keep up in the air. The bird paused, stopped still an instant, and fell with a heavy splash to the slushy ground. "Can I possibly have missed it?" shouted Stepan Arkadyevich, who could not see for the smoke. "Here it is," said Levin, pointing to Laska, who, with one ear pricked up, wagging the tip of her shaggy tail, was coming slowly back as though she would prolong the pleasure, and seemingly smiling, was bringing the dead bird to her master. "Well, I'm glad you were successful," said Levin, who at the same time had a sense of envy that he had not succeeded in shooting the woodcock. "It was a bad shot from the right barrel," responded Stepan Arkadyevich, loading his gun. "Shh, here it comes." The shrill whistles rapidly following one another were heard again. Two woodcocks, playing and chasing one another, and only whistling, not crying, flew straight at the very heads of the sportsmen. There was the report of four shots, and like swallows, the woodcocks turned swift somersaults in the air and vanished from sight. The stand shooting was capital. Stepan Arkadyevich shot two more birds and Levin two, of which one was not found. It began to get dark. Venus, bright and silvery, shone with her soft light low down in the west, behind the birch trees, and high up in the east twinkled the red fires of somber Arcturus. Over his head, Levin made out the stars of the Great Bear and lost them again. The woodcocks had ceased flying, but Levin resolved to stay a little longer, till Venus, which he saw below a branch of birch, should be above it, and the stars of the Great Bear should be perfectly plain. Venus had risen above the branch, and the chariot of the Great Bear with its shaft was now all plainly visible against the dark blue sky. Yet still he waited. "Isn't it time to go home?" said Stepan Arkadyevich. It was quite still now in the copse, and not a bird was stirring. "Let's stay a little while," answered Levin. "As you like." They were standing now about 15 paces from one another. "Stiva," said Levin unexpectedly, "how is it you don't tell me whether your sister-in-law's married yet or when she's going to be?" Levin felt so resolute and serene that no answer he fancied could affect him, but he had never dreamed of the answer which Stepan Arkadyevich made. "She's never thought of being married and isn't thinking of it, but she's very ill, and the doctors have sent her abroad. They're positively afraid she may not live." "What?" cried Levin. "Very ill? What is wrong with her? How is she?" While they were speaking, Laska, with ears pricked up, was looking upward at the sky and reproachfully at them. "What a time they have chosen to gab," she was thinking. "There it comes. Here it is. Yes, sure enough, they'll miss it," thought Laska. But at that very instant, both suddenly heard a shrill whistle, which, as it were, smote on their ears, and both suddenly seized their guns, and two flashes gleamed, and two bangs sounded at the very same instant. The woodcock, flying high above, instantly folded its wings and fell into a thicket, bending down the delicate shoots. "Splendid! Together!" cried Levin, and he ran with Laska into the thicket to look for the woodcock. Oh, yes! What was it that was unpleasant, he recollected. Yes, Kitty's ill. Well, it can't be helped. I'm very sorry, he thought. "She's found it. Isn't she a clever girl?" he said, taking the warm bird from Laska's mouth and packing it into the almost full game bag. "I've got it, Stiva," he shouted. Chapter 16. On the way home, Levin asked all the details of Kitty's illness and of the Shcherbatskys' plans, and though he would have been ashamed to admit it, he was pleased at what he heard. He was pleased that there was still hope, and still more pleased that she, who had made him suffer, should be suffering so much. But when Stepan Arkadyevich began to speak of the causes of Kitty's illness and mentioned Vronsky's name, Levin cut him short. "I have no right whatever to know family matters, and to tell the truth, no interest in them either." Stepan Arkadyevich smiled a barely perceptible smile, catching the instantaneous change he knew so well in Levin's face, which had become as gloomy as it had been bright a minute before. "Have you quite settled about the forest with Rabinin?" asked Levin. "Yes, it's all settled. The price is magnificent. 38,000. 8 straight away and the rest in 6 years. I've been bothering about it for ever so long. No one would give more." "Then you're as good as giving away your forest for nothing," said Levin gloomily. "How do you mean, for nothing?" said Stepan Arkadyevich, with a good-humored smile, knowing that nothing would be right in Levin's eyes now. "Because the forest is worth at least 500 rubles, the Desityatina," answered Levin. "Oh, these farmers," said Stepan Arkadyevich playfully. "Your tone of contempt for us poor townfolk. But when it comes to business, we are better at it than anyone. I assure you I have reckoned it all out," he said, "and the forest is fetching a very good price. So much so that I'm afraid of this fellow's crying off, in fact." "You know it's not timber for us," said Stepan Arkadyevich, hoping by this distinction to convince Levin completely of the unfairness of his doubts. "But for the most part, firewood. And it won't run to more than 30 zassins of wood per desiatina. And he's paying me at the rate of 200 rubles the desiatina." Levin smiled contemptuously. "I know," he thought, "that fashion not only in him but in all city people who, after being twice in 10 years in the country, pick up 2 or 3 phrases and use them in season and out of season, firmly persuaded that they know all about it. Timber run to 30 zassins the desiatina. He says those words without understanding them himself. "I wouldn't attempt to teach you what you write about in your office," said he, "if need arose. I should come to you to ask about it. But you're so positive you know all the lore of the forest. It's difficult. Have you counted the trees?" "How count the trees?" said Stepan Arkadyevich, laughing, still trying to draw his friend out of his ill temper. "Count sand of seas and rays of stars, though could some higher power..." "Oh, well, the higher power of Ryabinin can. Not a single merchant ever buys a forest without counting the trees, unless they get it given them for nothing, as you're doing now. I know your forest. I go there every year shooting. And your forest worth 500 desiatina paid down, while he's giving you 200 by installments. So that, in fact, you're making him a present of 30,000. "Come, don't let your imagination run away with you," said Stepan Arkadyevich piteously. "Why was it none would give it, then?" "Why? Because he has an understanding with the merchant. He's bought them off. I've had to do with all of them. I know them. They're not merchants, you know. They're speculators. He wouldn't look at a bargain that gave him 10-15% profit, but holds back to buy a ruble's worth for 20 kopecks. Well, enough of it. You're out of temper." "Not in the least," said Levin gloomily as they drove up to the house. At the steps there stood a trap tightly covered with iron and leather, with a sleek horse tightly harnessed with broad collar straps. In the trap sat the chubby, tightly belted overseer who served Rabinin as coachman. Rabinin himself was already in the house and met the friends in the hall. Rabinin was a tall, thinnish, middle-aged man with mustache and a projecting, clean-shaven chin and prominent, muddy-looking eyes. He was dressed in a long-skirted blue coat with buttons below the waist at the back and wore high boots wrinkled over the ankles and straight over the calf, with big galoshes drawn over them. He mopped his face with his handkerchief, and wrapping himself in his coat, which sat extremely well as it was, he greeted them with a smile, holding out his hand to Stepan Arkadyevich as though he wanted to catch something. "So here you are," said Stepan Arkadyevich, giving him his hand. "That's capital. I did not venture to disregard Your Excellency's commands, though the road was extremely bad. I positively covered the whole way at a walk, but I am here on time. Konstantin Dmitrich, my respects." He turned to Levin, trying to seize his hand too. But Levin, scowling, made as though he did not notice his hand and took out the woodcocks. "Your honors have been diverting yourself with the chase. What kind of bird may it be, pray?" asked Rabinin, looking contemptuously at the woodcocks. "A great delicacy, I suppose." And he shook his head disapprovingly, as though he had grave doubts whether this game were worth the candle. Would you like to go into my study? Levin said in French to Stepan Arkadyevich, scowling morosely. Go into my study. You can talk there. Quite so, wherever you please, said Rabinin with supercilious dignity, as though wishing to make it felt that others might be in difficulties as to how to behave, and that he could never be in any difficulty about anything. On entering the study, Rabinin looked about, as it was a habit of his, as though seeking a holy image, but when he had found it, he did not cross himself. He scanned the bookcases and bookshelves, and with the same dubious air with which he had regarded the woodcocks, he smiled superciliously and shook his head disapprovingly, as though by no means willing to allow that this game either were worth the candle. "Well, have you brought the money?" asked Oblonsky. "Sit down." "Oh, don't trouble about the money. I've come to see you to talk it over." "What is there to talk over? But do sit down." "I don't mind if I do," said Rabinin, sitting down and leaning his elbows on the back of his armchair in a position of the intensest discomfort to himself. "You must knock it down a bit, Prince. It would be a sin otherwise. As for the money, it is ready definitely to the last kopeck. As for money down, there'll be no hitch there." Levin, who had meanwhile been putting his gun away in the cupboard, was just going out of the door, but catching the merchant's words, he stopped. "Why, you've got the forest for nothing as it is," he said. "He came to me too late, or I'd have fixed the price for him." Rabinin got up, and in silence with a smile, he looked up at Levin. "Konstantin Dmitrievich is very close," he said with a smile, turning to Stepan Arkadyevich. "There's definitely no dealing with him. I was bargaining for some wheat of him, and a pretty price I offer, too." "Why should I give you what's mine for nothing? I didn't pick it up off the ground, nor did I steal it, either." "Mercy on us. Nowadays there's positively no chance at all of stealing. With the definitively open courts and everything done in style, nowadays there's no question of stealing. We are just talking things over like gentlemen. His Excellency's asking too much for the forest. I can't make both ends meet over it. I must ask for a little concession." "But is the thing settled between you, or isn't it? If it's settled, it's useless haggling. But if it isn't," said Levin, "I'll buy the forest." The smile vanished at once from Rabinin's face. A hawk-like, greedy, cruel expression was left upon it. With rapid, bony fingers, he unbuttoned his coat, revealing a large shirt, bronze waistcoat buttons, and a watch chain, and quickly pulled out a fat old pocketbook. "Here you are. The forest is mine," he said, crossing himself quickly and holding out his hand. "Take the money. It's my forest." That Rabinin's way of doing business. He doesn't haggle over every copper, he added, scowling and waving the pocketbook. "I wouldn't be in a hurry if I were you," said Levin. "Come, really," said Oblonsky in surprise. "I've given my word, you know." Levin went out of the room, slamming the door. Rabinin looked toward the door and shook his head with a smile. "It's all youthfulness. Definitively nothing but childishness. Why, I'm buying it, upon my honor, simply believe me, for the glory of it, that Rabinin and no one else should have bought the copse of Oblonsky. And as to the profits, why, I must make what God gives. God's my witness, if you would kindly sign the title deed." Within an hour, the merchant, carefully stroking his wrapper down and hooking up his coat, with the agreement in his pocket, seated himself in his tightly covered trap and drove homeward. "Oh, these gentlefolk," he said to the overseer, "they are all made alike. They're a fine lot." "That's so," responded the overseer, handing him the reins and buttoning the leather apron. "But can I congratulate you on the purchase, Mikhail Ignatich?" "Well, well." Chapter 17. Stepan Arkadyevich went upstairs with his pocket bulging with notes which the merchant had paid him for 3 months in advance. The business of the forest was over, the money in his pocket. Their shooting had been excellent, and Stepan Arkadyevich was in the happiest frame of mind, and therefore felt especially anxious to dissipate the ill humor that had come upon Levin. He wanted to finish the day at supper as pleasantly as it had begun. Levin certainly was out of humor, and in spite of all his desire to be affectionate and cordial to his charming guest, he could not control his mood. The after effects of the intoxication of the news that Kitty had not married had gradually begun to work upon him. Kitty was not married and was ill, and ill from love for a man who had slighted her. This offense, as it were, rebounded upon him. Vronsky had slighted her, and she had slighted him, Levin. Consequently, Vronsky had the right to despise Levin, and therefore he was his enemy. But all this Levin did not think of. He vaguely felt that there was something in it insulting to him, and he was not angry now at what had disturbed him, but he felt foul of everything that presented itself. The stupid sale of the forest, the fraud practiced upon Oblonsky, and concluded in his house, exasperated him. "Well, finished," he said, meeting Stepan Arkadyevitch upstairs. "Would you like supper?" "Well, I wouldn't say no to it. What an appetite I get in the country." "Wonderful. Why didn't you offer Rabinin something?" "Oh, damn him." "Still, how you do treat him," said Oblonsky. "You didn't even shake hands with him." "Why not shake hands with him?" "Because I don't shake hands with a waiter, and a waiter is 100 times better than he is." "What a reactionist you are, really. What about the amalgamation of classes?" said Oblonsky. "Anyone who likes it is welcome to it, but it sickens me." "You're a downright reactionist, I see." "Really, I have never considered what I am. I am Konstantin Levin and nothing else." "And Konstantin Levin very much out of temper," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling. "Yes, I am out of temper, and do you know why?" "Because, excuse me, of your stupid sale." Stepan Arkadyevitch frowned good-humoredly, like one who feels himself teased and attacked for no fault of his own. "Come, enough about that," he said. "When did anybody ever sell anything without being told immediately after the sale it was worth much more? But when one wants to sell, no one will give anything. So I see you've a grudge against the unlucky Rabinin." "Maybe I have. And do you know why?" "You'll say again that I'm a reactionist or some other terrible word, but at the same it does annoy and anger me to see on all sides the impoverishing of the nobility to which I belong. And, in spite of the amalgamation of classes, I am glad to belong. And their impoverishment is not due to living in luxury. That would be nothing. Living in good style, that's the proper thing for noblemen. It's only the nobles who know how to do it. Now the peasants about us buy land, and I don't mind that. The gentleman does nothing while the peasant works and supplants the idle man. That's as it should be. And I welcome the peasant. But I do mind seeing the process of impoverishment from a sort of, I don't know what to call it, innocence. Here a Polish lessee bought for half its value a magnificent estate from a lady who lives in Nice. And there a merchant leases land worth 10 rubles in rent, the Desiatina, for 1 ruble. Here, for no kind of reason, you've made that cheat a present of 30,000 rubles. "Well, what should I have done? Counted every tree?" "Of course they must be counted. You didn't count them, but Rabinin did. Rabinin children will have means of livelihood and education, while yours, like as not, won't." "Well, you must excuse me, but there's something mean in this counting. We have our business and they have theirs, and they must make their profit. Anyway, the thing's done and there's an end of it. And here come some fried eggs, my favorite dish. And Agatha Mikhailovna will give us that marvelous herb brandy." Stepan Arkadyevitch sat down at the table and began jollying Agatha Mikhailovna, assuring her that it was long since he had tasted such a dinner and such a supper. "Well, you praise it at any rate," said Agatha Mikhailovna, "but Konstantin Dmitrievich, no matter what you give him, even a crust of bread, will just eat it and walk away." Though Levin tried to control himself, he was gloomy and silent. He wanted to put one question to Stepan Arkadyevitch, but he could not bring himself to the point, and could not find the words or the moment in which to put it. Stepan Arkadyevitch had gone down to his room, undressed, again washed, and attired in a nightshirt with goffered frills, had got into bed. But Levin still lingered in his room, talking of various trifling matters, and not daring to ask what he wanted to know. "How wonderfully they make the soap," he said, gazing at a piece of soap he was unwrapping, which Agatha Mikhailovna had placed in readiness for the guest. but a brand which Oblonsky did not use. Just look. Why, it's a work of art. Yes, everything's brought to such a pitch of perfection nowadays, said Stepan Arkadyevich, with a moist and blissful yawn. The theater, for instance, and the entertainments. Ah, he yawned. The electric light everywhere. Ah, yes, the electric light, said Levin. Yes. Oh, and where's Vronsky now? He asked, suddenly laying down the soap. Vronsky, said Stepan Arkadyevich, checking his yawn. He's in Petersburg. He left soon after you did and hasn't been once to Moscow since. And do you know, Kostya, I'll tell you the truth, he went on, leaning his elbow on the table, with his hand propping up his handsome ruddy face, in which his humid, good-natured, sleepy eyes shone like stars. It's your own fault. You took fright at the sight of your rival. But as I told you at the time, I couldn't say which had the better chance. Why didn't you fight it out? I told you at the time that, he yawned inwardly, without opening his mouth. Does he know, or doesn't he, that I did propose? Levin wondered, gazing at him. Yes, there's something humbugging, something diplomatic in his face. And feeling he was blushing, he looked Stepan Arkadyevich straight in the face without speaking. If there was anything on her side at that time, it was nothing but a superficial attraction, pursued Oblonsky. His being such a perfect aristocrat, you know, and his future position in society, had an influence not with her but with her mother. Levin scowled. The humiliation of his rejection stung him to the heart, as though it were a fresh wound he had only just received. But he was at home, and the walls of home are a support. Wait, wait, he began, interrupting Oblonsky. You talk of his being an aristocrat, but allow me to ask what it consists of, that aristocracy of Vronsky or anybody else, besides which I can be looked down upon. You consider Vronsky an aristocrat, but I don't. A man whose father crawled up from nothing at all by intrigue, and whose mother, God knows whom she wasn't mixed up with. No, excuse me, but I consider myself aristocratic, and people like me, who can point back in the past to three or four honorable generations of their family, of the highest degree of breeding, talent and intellect, of course, are another matter, and have never curried favor with anyone, never depended on anyone for anything, like my father and my grandfather. And I know many such. You think it mean of me to count the trees in my forest while you make Rabinin a present of 30,000, but you get from the government your life rent, and I don't know what, while I shall not, and so I prize what comes to me from my ancestors, or has been won by hard work. We are aristocrats, and not those who can only exist by favor of the powerful ones of this earth, and who can be bought for 20 kopecks. Well, but whom are you attacking? I agree with you, said Stepan Arkadyevich, sincerely and genially, though he was aware that in the class of those who could be bought for 20 kopecks, Levin was reckoning him as well. Levin's animation gave him genuine pleasure. Whom are you attacking? A good deal of what you say is not true about Vronsky, of course, but I won't talk about that. I tell you straight out, if I were you, I should go back with me to Moscow, and, no, I don't know whether you know it or not, but I don't care. And I tell you, I did propose and was rejected. And Katerina Alexandrovna is nothing now to me but a painful and humiliating reminiscence. Why? What nonsense. But we won't talk about it. Please forgive me if I've been nasty, said Levin. Now that he had opened his heart, he became as he had been in the morning. You're not angry with me, Stiva. Please don't be angry, he said, and smiling, he took his hand. Of course not. Not a bit. Nor is there any reason to be. I'm glad we've spoken openly. And do you know, stand shooting in the morning is usually good. Why not go? I might go, without sleeping, straight from shooting to the station. Capital. Chapter 18. Although all Vronsky's inner life was absorbed in his passion, his external life unalterably and inevitably followed along the old accustomed lines of his social and regimental ties and interests. The interests of his regiment took an important place in Vronsky's life, both because he was fond of the regiment and still more because the regiment was fond of him. They were not only fond of Vronsky and his regiment, they respected him too and were proud of him. Proud that this man with his immense wealth, his brilliant education and abilities, and the path open before him to every kind of success, distinction, and ambition, had disregarded all that, and of all the interests of life had the interests of his regiment and his comrades nearest to his heart. Vronsky was aware of his comrades' view of him, and in addition to his liking for that sort of life, he felt bound to keep up that reputation. It need not be said that he did not speak of his love to any of his comrades, nor did he betray his secret even in the wildest drinking bouts, though indeed he was never so drunk as to lose all control of himself. And he closed the mouths of any of his thoughtless comrades who attempted to allude to his liaison. But in spite of that, his love was known to all the town. Everyone guessed with more or less certainty at his relations with Madame Karenina. The majority of the younger men envied him for just what was the irksome factor in his love, the exalted position of Karenin, and the consequent transparency to society of their liaison. The greater number of the young women who envied Anna and had long been weary of having her called righteous rejoiced at the fulfillment of their predictions and were only waiting for a decisive turn in public opinion to fall upon her with all the weight of their scorn. They were already making ready their handfuls of mud to cast at her when the right moment arrived. The greater number of middle-aged people and certain great personages were displeased at the prospect of the impending scandal in society. Vronsky's mother, on hearing of his liaison, was at first pleased by it, because nothing to her mind gave such a finishing touch to a brilliant young man as a liaison in the highest society. She was pleased, too, that Madame Karenina, who had so taken her fancy and had talked so much of her son, was, after all, just like all the other pretty and decent women, according to the Countess Vronskaya's ideas. But she had heard of late that her son had refused a position offered him of great importance to his career, simply in order to remain in the regiment. Where could he constantly see Madame Karenina? She heard the great personages were displeased with him on this account, and she changed her opinion. She was vexed, too, that from all she could learn of this liaison, it was not that brilliant, graceful, worldly liaison which she would have welcomed, but a sort of Werther's desperate passion, so she was told, which might well lead him into follies. She had not seen him since his abrupt departure from Moscow, and she sent her elder son to bid him to come to her. This elder brother, too, was displeased with his younger brother. He did not distinguish what sort of love this might be, big or little, passionate or passionless, pure or impure. He kept a ballet girl himself, though he was the father of a family, so he was rather indulgent. But he knew that this love displeased those whom it was necessary to please, and therefore he did not approve of his brother's conduct. Besides the service and society, Vronsky had another great interest, horses. He was passionately fond of horses. That year, races and a steeplechase had been arranged for the officers. Vronsky had put his name down, bought a thoroughbred English mare, and in spite of his love, he was looking forward to the races with intense, though reserved, excitement. These two passions did not interfere with one another. On the contrary, he needed occupation and distraction quite apart from his love, so as to recruit and rest himself from the violent emotions that agitated him. Chapter 19. On the day of the races at Krasno Selo, Vronsky had come earlier than usual to eat beefsteak in the common mess room of the regiment. He had no need to be strict with himself, as his weight was exactly the required one. But still he had to avoid gaining flesh, and so he eschewed farinaceous and sweet dishes. He sat with his coat unbuttoned over a white waistcoat, resting both elbows on the table, and while waiting for the steak he had ordered, was looking over a French novel that lay open on his plate. He was only looking at the book to avoid conversation with the officers coming in and out, he was thinking. He was thinking of Anna's promise to see him today after the races. but he had not seen her for 3 days, and as her husband had just returned from abroad, he did not know whether she would be able to meet him today or not, and he did not know how to find out. He had had his last interview with her at his cousin Betsy's summer villa. He visited the summer villa of the Karenins as rarely as possible. Now he wanted to go there, and he pondered the question of how to do it. Of course I shall say Betsy has sent me to ask whether she's coming to the races. Of course I'll go, he decided, lifting his head from the book. And as he vividly pictured the happiness of seeing her, his face lighted up. Send to my house and tell them to have out the carriage and 3 horses as quickly as they can, he said to the servant who handed him the steak on a hot silver dish, and moving the dish up toward him, he began eating. From the adjoining billiard room came the sound of balls clicking, of talk and laughter. 2 officers appeared at the entrance door, one a young fellow with a weak, delicate face who had lately joined the regiment from the Corps of Pages, the other a plump, elderly officer with a bracelet on his wrist and little eyes lost in fat. Vronsky glanced at them, frowned, and looked down at his book as though he had not noticed them. He proceeded to eat and read at the same time. What? Fortifying yourself for your work? Said the plump officer, sitting down beside him. As you see, responded Vronsky, knitting his brows, wiping his mouth, and without looking at the officer. So you're not afraid of getting fat, said the latter, turning a chair around for the young officer. What? Said Vronsky angrily, making a wry face of disgust and showing his heavy teeth. You're not afraid of getting fat. Waiter, sherry, said Vronsky without replying, and moving the book to the other side of him, he went on reading. The plump officer took up the list of wines and turned to the young officer. You choose what we're to drink, he said, handing him the card and looking at him. Rhine wine, please, said the young officer, stealing a timid glance at Vronsky and trying to pull his scarcely visible mustache. Seeing that Vronsky did not turn round, the young officer got up. Let's go into the billiard room, he said. The plump officer rose submissively, and they moved toward the door. At that moment, there walked into the room the tan and well-built Captain Yashvin. Nodding with an air of lofty contempt to the 2 officers, he went up to Vronsky. Ah, here he is, he cried, bringing his big hand down heavily on his epaulette. Vronsky looked around angrily, but his face lighted up immediately with his characteristic expression of calm and firm friendliness. That's it, Alyosha, said the captain in his loud baritone. Have a bite and drink 1 tiny glass. Oh, I'm not very hungry. There go the inseparables, the Yashvin dropped, glancing sarcastically at the 2 officers who were at that instant leaving the room, and he bent his long legs swathed in tight riding breeches and sat down in the chair, too low for him, so that his knees were cramped up at a sharp angle. Why didn't you turn up at theater at Krasnoselo yesterday? Numerovna wasn't at all bad. Where were you? I was late at the Versky, said Vronsky. Ah, responded Yashvin. Yashvin, a gambler and a rake, a man not merely without any principles, but of immoral principles. Yashvin was Vronsky's greatest friend in the regiment. Vronsky liked him both for his exceptional physical strength, which he showed for the most part by being able to drink like a fish, and to do without sleep without being in the slightest degree affected by it, and for his great strength of character, which he showed in his relations with his comrades and superior officers, commanding both fear and respect, and also at cards when he would play for tens of thousands, and however much he might have drunk, always with such skill and decision that he was reckoned the best player in the English club. Vronsky respected and liked Yashvin particularly because he felt Yashvin liked him, not for his name and his money, but for himself. And of all men, he was the only one with whom Vronsky would have liked to speak of his love. He felt that Yashvin, in spite of his apparent contempt for every sort of feeling, was the only man who could, so he fancied, comprehend the intense passion which now filled his whole life. Moreover, he felt certain that Yashvin, as it was, took no delight in gossip and scandal, and interpreted his feeling rightly, that is to say, knew and believed that this passion was not a joke, not a pastime, but something more serious and important. Vronsky had never spoken to him of his passion, but he was aware that he knew all about it, and that he put the right interpretation on it, and he was glad to see this in his eyes. "Ah, yes," he said to the announcement that Vronsky had been at the Verskys, and his black eyes shining, he plucked at his left mustache and began twisting it into his mouth, a bad habit he had. "Well, and what did you do yesterday? Win anything?" asked Vronsky. 8,000. "But 3 don't count. The chap will hardly pay up." "Oh, then you can afford to lose over me," said Vronsky, laughing. The Ashman had betted heavily on Vronsky in the races. "No chance of my losing. Makotin's the only one who's a dangerous entrant." And the conversation passed forecasts of the coming race, the only thing Vronsky could think of just now. "Come along, I've finished," said Vronsky, and getting up, he went to the door. The Ashman got up too, stretching his long legs and his long back. "It's too early for me to dine, but I must have a drink. I'll come along directly." "Hi, wine," he shouted in his rich voice, that was so famous at drill and set the window shaking. "No, I don't need it," he shouted again immediately after. "You're going home, so I'll go with you." And he walked out with Vronsky.